Thank you all for being with us for Political Rewind today. Glad to have you listening. And those of you who are watching on Facebook Live, watching Political Rewind. We have a terrific panel lined up to talk about many issues that are in the news, political news today. Just for a moment or two before I introduce the panel, and we do, I want to make a clarification about a statement that I made on the show yesterday that a number of you, not a lot, but enough of you that I think it's worth saying something about, called me out on, and I think called me out correctly on. Yesterday, we were talking about the President's State of the Union address, and I said that I didn't want to do serious fact-checking because we get consumed by fact-checking when we do that. And a number of you, and I said it really in a bad way. I mean, I just did not articulate it particularly well, because what a number of you who've contacted me, some of you very politely, others not so much, was that you thought I was saying we don't want to hold politicians accountable for what they say. And I want to tell you that is not what I think this show is all about. We frequently do, in fact, look at what politicians have said, are saying, and point out when they're not being accurate, honest, whatever. And in fact, yesterday, when this all came up, I had just pointed out that President Trump, who talked about record economic growth, was flat out wrong. And I pointed to the fact that even Jimmy Carter, during the so-called years of malaise, had better economic growth than President Trump suggests he has this at this current time. I also pointed out that when he awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Rush Limbaugh, I thought it was important to put it in the context of the fact that people like Mother Teresa, Rosa Parks, have been awarded that medal. And I mentioned some of the bigoted statements that over the years Rush Limbaugh has made. So let me make sure that I say exactly what I think about what Political Rewind is for all of you who listen so faithfully to the show. Yes, fact-checking is important. But if we had tried to fact-check the entire Trump State of the Union speech on Monday night, that's all we would have done for the entire show. And I don't think that's what Political Rewind is. There is a reason that newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times have analysts who look at the larger picture of what's going on politically, and then fact-checking teams who, in fact, separate from the analysis, do tick off all of the things that are true or not true about what they're hearing from various politicians. It is a time-consuming and laborious process. So, our goal here is to emphasize analysis from the terrific panelists who come in here every day. And that's what I hope we do really well. And at the same time, over the 6 years we've been on the air, there are many examples of times in which we have, in fact, called into account political leaders who have said things that simply aren't correct. And in a polite and respectful way, we frequently, in fact, call out panelists on the show when we think they're making comments that aren't accurate. So, all that said, I apologize for my muddled way of expressing myself yesterday, and I don't blame some of you for contacting me to say that you were disappointed that we didn't want to hold politicians accountable. I hope this makes it clearer to you. As I always say, if you're still not sure what I'm talking about, you can email me at bnigut@gpb.org. You can tweet. You can put up Facebook comments. And we always take a look at what you have to say. I would ask that you be as respectful as the panelists are when they talk about issues on the show. That isn't always the case, and there's nothing I can do about that. But respect is something we value highly on Political Rewind. All right, enough of that. Let's get to the news of the day. Kevin Riley is here with us. He is the boss, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We're really glad to have you with us Thursdays on Political Rewind. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
It's great to be here, and I'm going to be careful not to say anything muddled myself, but I can't make any promises on that.
Yeah, well, neither can I, clearly. Right next to you, for those who are watching on Facebook Live, is Brian Robinson. Brian is a government affairs specialist, a former communications director for Governor Nathan Deal. You have some political clients these days, but it isn't what you're focused on primarily.
Now, Robinson Republic is a communications firm. We do public affairs communication, some public relations, some political communication. So it's a grab bag. Give me a call if you find yourself in need of these services.
I should have vetted my comments through you earlier. Mo Ivory is back with us. We're always glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Mo, among other things, is a political activist who works with Fair Fight Action and who clearly is proud of her affiliation with Georgia State University, which those of you watching can see she's wearing in bright blue today. Hi, Mo.
Yeah, hello. And my opinions are my own. And I love facts.
Yeah, thank you. it's great to have all of you here, but today we have a double shot from the AJC. James Salzer, who knows more about the Georgia State budget than many of the legislators at the Capitol. James, we're so glad you're here. When I say that, Brian Robinson is nodding. We know that there are legislators who come to you at times and say, James, can you please explain to me what the heck is going on with the budget? Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
And I will add that during the Deal administration, we had a transition when the budget director moved on to another state job, and the governor gave serious consideration to asking James to be the state budget director.
Oh my God. Completely polluted your reputation right on our air.
That would have turned out poorly.
All right. I want to talk about the budget, and I want to get into some of the numbers that are of concern to a lot of people out there. But before we do, I do think, James, we ought to start by talking about the kind of extraordinary politics that are going on around the budget right now. Let's start with you, and I want everybody to get in on this. So we know that there's been a clash between particularly the Speaker and House Republican leaders and Governor Kemp over the cuts that the governor wants in the budget. So as a starting point, before we even talk about this escalation which took place yesterday, why are they clashing so in such a strong way about the budget the governor wants them to bring to him?
Because I think, it's been going on since August when the governor announced that he wanted spending cuts. And, you know, August is, I think when he announced it, it was something like 6 weeks after that budget went into effect. And it was, you know, 3 or 4 months after the legislature passed it. So I think they were just taken aback by the fact that all of a sudden he's saying, you know, we need to make these cuts. And he didn't say it at the time, but it is, as it turned out, the big item he wanted, the big ask that he was going to ask for in January was the $2,000 teacher pay raise that would make his campaign promise true that he made in 2018 that he was going to increase.
Kevin, part of what James is saying also is I think in August when he announced 4% cuts in that existing budget that was already being used, 4% then, 6% in the budget they have to pass for the next fiscal year, which starts in the summer. He also didn't bring legislators in to consult with him on this. He just flat out announced it.
Right. I mean, one of the things that James has reported is that really only slightly less than a fourth of the overall state budget can really be affected by what they're talking about. So they're being asked to cut that 4% and 6% from that amount. And, I mean, they were surprised, I think, is the key thing because, I mean, if you work in the Georgia legislature, in particular the House, that's your big thing, right, James? The budget. I mean, the control and the opportunity to shape state policy through funding is what gives you your power.
Yeah, and you also have, I mean, you understand that, like, for instance, the House Budget Chairman Terry Englund and Senate Chairman Jack Hill, those guys are not part-time legislators.
Yeah.
I mean, they are following everything that's going on in the economy, what's going on. You know, they're looking at everything that's going on in Georgia. And so to them, I mean, it's like that's their baby when they pass that budget. That is really important to them. And they, once it's passed, they're still working on it, talking about it, looking at what's going to happen the next year. And so they during their session and in the off session, I mean, they're entertaining people who are like agency heads mm-hmm. or people who work for agencies, as the governor is, talking about their needs, talking about what's going on and where they need help or where they don't, where they can take a cut. But usually it's, they need help for something. And so, you know, for him to then go in awe, I mean, the reaction was, you know, instantly was not happy. They were instantly not happy. And then since then, you know, they've been unhappy, saying, thinking, and I have no idea whether this is, whether, you know, this is, you know, how, what degree this is accurate, but that the governor's, that the governor directed agency people not to
cooperate.
And again, I don't, you know, I have no information that is, you know, that I know for a fact that that's true. But that's the feeling, is that they're not getting cooperation. And so that's kind of added to the antagonism.
So, Mo, part of this becomes an issue. I think it's fair to say. I mean, some people would call these cuts draconian. I don't know if that's an overstatement or not. A couple people are already, Salzer's already shaking his head no. Robinson's just sort of, I don't know. But, Mo, there is no question that aspects of this budget are going to be detrimental to a number of constituencies around the state of Georgia.
Sure. And you hear a lot of conversation about the folks that are going to be most hurt are actually people that voted for him and are a huge part of his base.
Rural Georgians, perhaps.
Absolutely. That's exactly who I'm talking about. And so it's sort of, you know, the press rollout of all this has been so awful in the sense of how people feel about what's happening. You know, you have the governor saying, we're going to do this, and then you have his whole entire party having a problem with what they're doing. We have this break. A lot of people don't even understand what the break really means, what's going to be discussed. But what they do hear about are things that they thought were going to be changed, you know, that there were going to be more, you know, less hospital closures, more doctors being sent to rural areas. There were not going to be education. When you think about the programs where high school students can go to colleges and he wants to take money out of that, you know, that's a real blow to lower income communities who depend on the ability to send their students to, you know, take these college courses while they're still in high school. And I have children that go to Maynard Jackson High School who have taken advantage of those programs, right? I know there are friends who come into our colleges and they're already sophomores or juniors because of these things. So a lot of the things that he said during the campaign to get elected are sort of seem to not be a part of what he has put forth in the budget.
So, Brian, I want to restate, before we get into this latest escalation yesterday, something, and I'd like you to weigh in on this. James made an important point here. Part of what's going on between especially the House leaders and the governor is different agendas for how they want money spent this year. James points out the governor made this commitment to give teachers $5,000 raises when he became governor. He already has ponied up $3,000 of that in the budget that we're living under right now. So now he said, I don't even want to wait another year. I wanted the extra $2,000 now, which puts constraints on the rest of the spending. Whereas House leaders have been pushing back on that because they're committed to another income tax cut, which they think is helpful for business in the state, but clearly helpful for them in their politics as they all run for re-election. So this, part of this is just that, a fight over what priorities House leaders and a governor want.
A lot to unpack there, Bill.
Okay.
I think some of this is leverage. I don't know that there is a huge push or desire amongst the Republican caucuses in, or cauci, in both houses, are that hungry about getting another tax cut. You'll recall we did this in 2018, did the quarter point cut. Mm-hmm. Not a single Republican legislator really campaigned on that issue. It wasn't in any of the mail pieces. It wasn't something that voters talked about. And in fact, internal polling showed that voters didn't care that much about it, which makes sense because the average Georgia household got $47 in savings from that cut. This would be an additional $47. And it's not making an impact because people aren't seeing it. Their paychecks are being eaten up by insurance costs, premiums, et cetera. So they're not getting this windfall. It's not something they noticed. The way you notice the national tax cut earlier that same year in 2018, people saw that. It was a significant difference. So I don't know that it delivers much bang for the buck, and it's going to add to the cuts. It'd be another $550 million, which is a huge, huge bite out of a $28 billion budget. So I think it's a leverage point. What the speaker said on the teacher pay raises is, hey, look, that wasn't my campaign promise. That was yours.
Well, right.
What are you going to give me? What are you going to give me for me to give you that? Because like $2,000, we're talking about rural cuts. A $2,000 pay raise, which will make it five overall in 3 years, that is rural development because much of that's being shot directly into rural economies where $2,000 is a really big deal.
Okay, let me, Kevin, bring this up to speed now. I've teased this long enough.
Okay.
Yesterday, this fight between the governor's office and, again, James, primarily the House side, right? Okay. Yesterday, David Ralston said, we're not going to be able to resolve this fight while we're in session. And he did something rather remarkable in an election year. He called a suspension, a halt, to the 40-day clock for, what, 8 days now, plus 9 days? So they could presumably work on the budget, I assume, try to get together with the governor's people, figure things out. But in an election year, that kind of halt is pretty remarkable. They all want to get out of the Capitol and go back, raise their campaign funds and campaign for their reelections. And then the governor sends out this letter in which he, I'm not going to read all of it, but his people say the governor's budget proposals are conservative and balanced, reflecting our values and visions as a state. His budget fully funds public education, provides long overdue pay raises for teachers. But then here's the pertinent line. While we respect the legislature's purview, the governor does not need a lesson in conservatism from a man who brokered a deal with Democrats just last week for political gamesmanship. And what he's talking about there, of course, is there was this move by the speaker and Democrats working together to try to create a bill that would change the way in which we're voting, especially for Senate seat number two. We've talked about it on the show, and the speaker was trying to give some leverage to Doug Collins. But for Kemp to introduce that here, the governor doesn't need lessons in conservatism.
Well,
that was an upping the ante.
Well, I think it's absolutely clear now that the Republicans have been so dominant in state government now, they're tired of fighting with Democrats, and now they're going to fight with each other, right? But I want to come back to Brian. I mean, you were part of a governor's, staff, and you rolled out budget priorities. You handled conflicts with the legislature. What's your assessment of why and how Kemp's doing here? Why do this?
Actually, I think the way that Kemp is managing this is really more of a reverting to the norms of old. This is what it was like with Governor Miller and Speaker Murphy. There was obviously a lot of headbutting between Glenn Richardson and Sonny Perdue, both of those are intra-party collisions there. So I think the deal years were actually the anomaly.
Yeah.
And here's how he did it. And I'm not saying this is a model for all governors and speakers to follow, but it worked for Deal. Every single day, Deal's chief of staff texted the budget committee chairman in both houses every day of the year, not just during session. They were in constant communication with the speaker and the lieutenant governor. And when there was something tough on the they would bring them in on the front end and be like, all right, guys, we all got to bite the bullet on here. I need skin of the game. What are we going to have to do to get buy-in? Now, that may come with Kemp and the General Assembly over the next few years. But any time that you start having to cut, you're going to have a fight. And the governor is in a tight spot here because we are a balanced budget state. He can't make money fall out of the sky. It's going to be tough choices no matter what. And he can't do anything that's going to be a clean shot. He's going to be attacked no matter what he does to balance the budget. And so I actually do feel a lot of sympathy for him because I was in that office during the Great Recession. I mean, these cuts are child's play compared to what I had to put up with.
James, you're nodding at just about everything Brian's saying.
Yeah, this is my fourth budget cut session, I guess, in the 30 years I covered the legislature. And it's these cuts are nothing like the Great Recession, like the dot-com recession, like the 91 recession, or 90 recession, I forgot which one it was. But anyway, earlier in the decade. But the the cuts, I mean, in the Great Recession involved furloughing teachers, eliminating, I mean, getting rid of teachers, getting rid of, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of state employees. There's no comparison between the two.
All right.
And he's right. And he also is right that this is completely an anomaly. I mean, excuse me, the Deal administration was a complete anomaly. I mean, they worked together in a way that I've never seen. And, you know, even when I covered politics in Texas, it was nothing like this.
The governor would argue that he is taking strong action to prevent a slowdown in the economy. And there are the credit rating agencies seem to think that that's not a bad move. So we have to give him that.
Right.
But I want to talk a little bit more for a minute, at least, about the politics of this, Mo. Even as we're sitting here talking about the budget, Kevin Riley's employee, Greg Bluestein, has filed a piece on AJC.com. I'll read you a couple of paragraphs. You can respond. Georgia Democrats are seizing on Governor Brian Kemp's, quote, extreme, unquote, proposed budget cuts to try to boost legislative candidates in competitive 2020 races. The Democratic Party of Georgia on Thursday launched a, quote, don't cut Georgia's future, unquote, campaign that highlighted Kemp's proposals to cut about $500 million from the state's budget over 2 years. So Democrats trying to take advantage of the turmoil that seems to be going on over the budget that Republicans are fighting about.
Sure. Well, I mean, it would only be, you know, smart for them to point out the things that are actually happening and to, you know, strengthen up the base around it. And so I think it's the, you know, right move for Democrats to do that. But I think the way that the governor is behaving, especially when you read that last statement there, you know, just really lines up with the sort of Trump politics and tone that is evident in, you know, his administration or in his attitude. And so I think that to sort of compare it to all of the other sessions that have had, you know, very strong budget concerns and deeper cuts and all that, is not the same because our country is completely different. And this is all being lined up for what's going to happen in 2020. So I think that tone, I don't think that he's going to come forward with a tone of bipartisanship or a tone of even working together. Like you said, that Governor Deal used to go and text in the morning and talk in that way. And I just don't think that's the tone that he has set from the very beginning, that he would do that. And it's more about politics and the way that he wants to be viewed. And I think that he's just opening up the door. You know, I don't think the Republicans have had a good last couple of weeks period altogether.
And yet, Kevin Riley, according to your poll, even the last comment before we go to the break, and yet according to your most recent poll, Governor Kemp is at 60% approval rating. And he didn't get there with just Republican support in Georgia.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, although while the poll was taken after he announced some of this initial budget-cutting stuff, there's been a lot of stuff in the news since then, so we'll see if that sort of approval rating holds up.
Let me do this. Let me get to a break, and then when we come back, I would love to go over just a couple of the areas with you, James, and get everybody else involved, where we think there's going to be some pain if the budget is passed and sign quite the way Governor Kemp wants it to. We'll do that after we pause for these messages on Political Rewind. Kevin Riley, Mo Ivory, Brian Robinson, James Salzer, all in the studio today. We're going to go over just a few of the areas that people have talked about most particularly in terms of budget cuts. Before we do, the standard disclaimer that I always want to give when we do budget talks is GPB is a state agency. We receive funding from the state largely for things like infrastructure, for our education programs here. I do want to always say that the programming here, Political Rewind, On Second Thought, and the staffing of those programs does not come from state money. We're all donor supported. And by the way, thank you, donors, for keeping us going. All right. With that said, James, a few of the areas that people have pointed out that they're concerned about. Mo mentioned rural Georgia. And so we can talk more about that. But mental health services is getting a lot of attention. Tell us about that.
Right. So we had a week of budget hearings a couple weeks ago where every agency, the director came in, and the two takeaways that were most kind of startling, one of them was definitely mental health. The agency directors do an impact statement kind of thing when they present their proposal. And it was particularly alarming because essentially the director said that initially said that cutting some of these mental health programs could lead to more suicide, to more people wandering the street, you know, kind of thing, and not getting treatment down the road, because the population that needs drug treatment and mental health services is growing. She said, and you know, there's just no way to say, well, we're gonna reduce some of these programs and then treat more people.
All right.
And I was gonna say the other one, and he's a little bit freer to talk because he's an elected official, but was Gary Black's testimony from agriculture, I reported on this in I think September or October, but for the legislators to hear that, for instance, we're gonna have. We will have fewer like food inspections, food safety inspections. You know, is like what? You know, we have more restaurants. More, yeah. You know, as you said, we have more supermarkets. We have more not 7-Elevens, but you know, other places where they sell food, we're not going to be able to fill these vacant positions.
And while we're listening, just one more quick one, and then we'll open it up, is criminal justice, mm-hmm. where cutting back on the number of public defender slots that are available, but increasing funding for prosecutorial initiatives in the state.
Right. But although, you know, politically that fits in.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
I mean, politically, that's he's
got it.
He ran on a campaign of getting tough on crime and particularly gang-related stuff. And in looking at the budget, I'm not sure how much the public defenders would. I mean, how that would affect them.
Okay. Okay. All right, everybody, jump on anything you want, Mo. You've got your hand up. Go.
Because I wanted to talk to Brian about this. You know, Governor Deal.
Not popularly.
Governor Deal had such a sweeping criminal reform, you know, and is touted for that. And when we talk about this criminal, you know, the cuts in bringing more prosecutors and less defenders seems to go against, you know, everything that Governor Deal tried to do to, you know, reform criminal
accountability
justice.
Accountability courts being a prime example.
Sure. And in the, you know, all shrouded over the national and state statistics that crime is decreasing. So, you know, that hardcore, you know, I'm going to go in and I'm going to do this. You know, we know who that affects. It affects Black men. It affects Black communities, Black families. So it's really important for people to understand when they're reading this, you know, what and compare it to what we have had in that area in progress in the 8 years before.
Look. You're not going to find anybody who's a bigger champion of the accountability courts, the veterans courts, that the drug courts that Governor Deal championed and put into place. I will say by unanimous margins many years in the General Assembly. Again,
I would say that is one of the most remarkable things I have ever seen politically, that Deal was able to do that stuff, because the arguments to make those changes, setting aside funding and everything else, were nuanced, which almost never works in politics. You know, the simple, straightforward messages tend to win out, and Deal over time was able to convince virtually everybody that these things were worth doing. And, you know, no matter how you feel about
it, from the communications office, that's what I think probably was
he did overcome shortcomings in that office. Yeah. And no matter what you think about it, I mean, I get there are two sides of that, and some people would argue differently.
Yeah, because it wasn't perfect, but
But to pull that off, and then Kemp sent a pretty strong message, right? That no, that's not my priority.
Look, it wasn't perfect. I don't know what that means, but I can tell you this. Within a couple of years, the number of African-American men, the group you just referenced yourself, the number of them going into state prisons went down by 20%. I mean, that's a remarkable number. That saves lives. Mm-hmm. That keeps families together. But it also keeps those offenders from becoming career criminals. Mm-hmm. It saves taxpayers over $20,000 per head. And that's my argument on this. I am making a point. Is that the accountability courts don't lead to more crime. You're not putting criminals back on the streets to recommit crimes. You are giving them a chance to reform. You're giving them the wraparound services to get on the right path. And you're look, It is so inefficient and expensive to put somebody who is a nonviolent offender into prison. It only leads to bad outcomes. So there's a smarter way to do it. Deal put us on the right path. And here's my argument during budget cutting years. We should be doubling down on accountability courts and drug courts and veterans because it's going to save us in the other areas of the budget.
Okay, that's an interesting point.
I don't think it was that subtle messaging because what Governor Deal did was going to be supported by Democrats because it was a more humane policy or whatever reasons. But as a Republican, if you say, we're going to save the state a lot of money, they've been watching corrections spending just go through the roof in the last 20 years. I mean, we're spending over $1 billion, over $100 million a year just to house inmates in private prisons.
So
it's not, you know, that's a very easy message, I would think, if I'm for Republican legislators.
Can I say, Bill, as a point of historical reference, I think it's important in clarifying, when Deal came into office in 2011, we were in the depths of the Great Recession. There was no money. We were still cutting what had been cut to the bone. We were cutting through bone at that juncture. And the Department of Corrections came to Deal during the transition and said, our prisons are teeming. They are crowded. We've got to build a new prison. It'll be $265 million. And Deal said, no.
Yeah.
There's a better way. We never spent that $265 million. We never built that other prison. And show me where we've had this crime explosion because we didn't put more people in that new $265 million prison.
A couple things, James. First of all, you know, one thing we talked about the fact that after the governor announced last summer in August his 4% cut immediately,
right.
The speaker said, "I want to have hearings with agency heads now. Let's accelerate our timetable for hearings. Let's not wait till the first week after the session starts." And that's when we believe the governor instructed agency heads not to cooperate.
Right? In those hearings, I was saying in general.
But here's the point I really want to make. Mm-hmm. You have a story in today's newspaper that tells us just how significant the budget hearings that legislators have are because of what can sometimes be revealed when agency heads come and talk about their departments. Right. What's that story today?
So I reported in, I think it was October, kind of what some of the proposals were for how they're going to deal with employees, who they're going to lay off or who they were going to jobs they were not going to fill. And I mentioned somewhere in the story, I mentioned, oh, they're going to cut the pay of educators in state prisons. And then yesterday at a hearing, the Commissioner of Corrections talked about the fact that they had some people in instruction in state prisons that were being paid six-figure salaries. And some of them were retired from the public education system, which means they were getting a pension. And they were getting six-figure salaries. And his line was that I think caught everybody, you know, kind of drove home. The point was we hand out GEDs and technical instruction. We don't hand out PhDs. And that kind of like resonated that they were paying twice what the average Georgia public school teacher makes to people that were essentially in instruction.
Yeah, that's Mo. You know, it's a remarkable figure that suddenly comes to light. And you know, you could good for Governor Kemp for wanting to increase the salary of public school teachers across the state. But when you compare it to what
he and the commissioner both recommended that those salaries be cut.
Okay, fine, good.
They recommended that the $110,000 salaries be cut. Well, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that conversation is not even one I knew about until we just started talking about that in your article this morning. But it's hard to understand why you're thinking about cutting and all of these programs that are so important, and then you're having conversations with the heads, but that doesn't come up as an item that was automatically going to be cut. I mean, why hadn't that come up? I'm wondering why that had never come up before as part of the Department of Corrections overview. Six-figure salaries for GEDs, but the teachers in public schools are getting $5,000. I'm just not sure I understand why that has never come up before.
All right. So let's go back. We're going to watch your reporting on the budget.
And you said and the budget for the Department of Corrections is out the roof.
Yeah, it's about $1 billion a year for corrections. But again, it's been kind of stable during the deal years, hasn't gone up that much. But there, because so much other thing, many other things in the state budget are formula driven, like education and Medicaid. Corrections actually had the biggest hit of all agencies.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to listen to the commissioner talk about, you know, how they were going to handle it.
So before we finish talking about the budget, Brian, I just wonder if this pause in the session, this 8-day pause, you would agree, I think, that it's unusual in an election year for legislators to want to extend their session. They'd like to get out if they could by St. Patrick's Day, because they cannot raise money while they're in session, and they're limited in how much campaigning they can do. So first of all, I'm right, I think, about that, yeah?
Well, particularly these days, there was a time when our primaries were in the summer, in July. Now they're in May because of federal court intervention having to do with how long you have to mail in ballots and stuff. So now is a very short window of time that they have, if they have primary opposition, to raise money, wage a campaign. Oh, and also, these guys are part-time legislators. When the bell rings at sine die on the last day of session, they got to get up and go back to work at their real jobs that pays for their mortgages. So they've got a lot going on in a very compressed amount of time. So I'm sure there's a lot of groaning and consternation about this. But it is a fact of life and a budget-cutting time, because you're going to have a lot of people at the table. If you try to shove something through without a lot of buy-in, you run the risk of having a budget voted down on the floor, which nobody wants to see. That's not what usually happens. We usually get very high majorities for the budget. So I think it's probably wise. I know the governor wasn't happy about it. He pushed back on it to some degree. But the legislature is going to, you know, flex this muscle that they have, because it's the muscle they have. Yep. You know, the governor of the state of Georgia is a very powerful constitutional governor. So the legislature doesn't have the powers that others do in other states. This is where they can call the shots.
All right.
I was going to say I don't know. If my 30 years, I don't think they've ever come close to voting down a budget. It also is not unusual for them to take time off to work on the budget.
But
they just usually do it.
Year.
Well, even in election year, but they do it. But they do it later. They usually the House has passed a budget, Senate's passed a version of it, and then they take time off to work on it. But this period in this early in the year, it is unusual.
Kevin, before we take another break, there is also always this to say about a budget where they're trying to cut, and even if the cuts aren't draconian, they are significant. And as Speaker Ralston pointed out the last time he was on Political Rewind, it is one thing to say, for the governor to say, yeah, we need major cuts in the budget. It's another thing for each legislator to look at how lines in the budget are going to be received by their constituents in their districts back home, which is where rubber really meets the road on what you're willing to accept as a legislator.
Well, yeah, and I think this has become clear in James' reporting. That's really what has some of those legislators ticked off. They worked on a specific thing, in some cases, for years. It's an important initiative. They've talked about it, and now it's on the chopping block.
All right, last question, James. Is this... for a while, I actually wondered if they were genuinely going to take this time off, or whether this was a maneuver to try to get the governor's attention and say, you better get serious about this. Obviously, I was wrong. They're doing it. Do you believe that they're going to use this period productively and actually try to resolve problems, or is this still part of the maneuvering between the governor's office and the House?
I mean, that's a good question, and I have to say they are having not only the House, the Senate, which doesn't vote on the budget until the end of the House passes it. They're all having hearings next week. Now those will be, I'm sure, heavily covered, and so. That's a good point, I think they are working on the budget.
Okay.
I don't think it's just show.
All right, I got to get to a break. Tom Faust points out there are some of you who have been pointing out that who are listening and are tweeting to us, and James, we can say it very quickly, the governor wants pay raises, but there's also been tinkering with teacher pensions, which in the long run could have a very negative impact on those very same people.
Right, but I think...
But they're not going to do
it. I don't think they're going to do it.
Yeah, this is not the year you want to mess
around
with
teacher pensions.
They've
been talking about that for years.
But of course, their pensions are another
right. Point, right? Yes, and their pensions are.
All right, we got a couple of other legislative issues that I really want to talk about when we come back from a break. James, I hope later in the session, as this is all playing out, stay with us, but I can't wait to talk to you later in the session about the budget as well. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a minute. Kevin Riley, you know, we knew that a legislative session couldn't possibly go by without a religious liberty bill of one sort or another being introduced. It's just... The conservative legislators are completely incapable of pulling back from something like that. And now we have one. Marty Harbin in the Senate, has introduced legislation that would protect faith-based organizations who decide they do not want to let same-sex couples adopt children. One of the larger impacts of this measure is that I think there's a great appetite, certainly on the House side, to pass a bill that will make it easier for families to adopt because of the huge number of Georgia children who are in foster care. And last year and in other sessions, everything that comes along that deals with the LGBTQ community not being able to adopt from faith-based organizations has stopped this from happening. And I think it's fair to say that Ralston and others in the House are unhappy about it. But here we go again. It's going to be an issue, and we're going to have to see how it all works out.
Yeah, well, the legislature's tried for a while now, right, to keep passing legislation to make it easier to adopt children. And then that gives the opening to some people to attach something like this to it. I mean, Ralston's been pretty clear, I think, that he wants to push forward this legislation and get it done that makes it easier to adopt and will probably keep anything else from happening. But we've seen stranger things, right, James?
Right. Like last year, abortion.
Of course. Yeah. Last year, a bill to virtually outlaw abortion. This is a play to the base, pure and simple.
Absolutely. And I mean, we've been through what happens when these religious bills come up and how automatically you start talking about the economy with the film industry and how this will affect people wanting to stay here and work in the industry and bring their business here. And I think that, you know, that's what will I don't think this will pass, first of all, and not in an election year and not at a time when they're talking about decreasing the tax credits and all of that. So I just think that it's a important. You know, when you say that during session, the legislators are not able to campaign, this is their campaigning. Right. So they're not campaigning, but they absolutely are campaigning and they're sticking to the things that they've told their base. So this is the way to keep. I did it, you know, so they can come back and they can say, you know, I was there fighting for it and they just wouldn't allow it. So that is the campaigning that they're doing right now. And he obviously is doing that again.
Brian, no one, I don't think, has struggled as much as your former boss, Governor Nathan Deal, with how to resolve what I believe to be a sincere belief by people who want to restrict adoption, I think they're personally, I'm sorry to see it, I guess they believe it sincerely, but your boss struggled with that mightily.
He sure did. Let me take you behind the scenes a bit. I mean, he is now 77, 78 years old, Southern Baptist.
Yeah.
So he is culturally, he is personally inclined toward protecting religious expression. I mean, it was something he really struggled with. I think in a broad sense, he believes people need those protections. Where he ended up landing was, well, those rights are already protected. And what this seems to do is send the signal that we're not welcoming, send the signal that we're open to discrimination. So that's where he really is, as much as anybody, somebody who really was torn. And I did not know the day he vetoed that bill. I'd already left the office. I was watching the live stream because I honestly did not know at that moment what he was going to do. Wow. Because I had heard him express both sides through the years. And on this, I think you have a handful of legislators who care passionately about this. They are religious conservatives. I do believe that they are sincere in their beliefs. I do think that they believe they are doing something that is right by their Christian faith. I don't think that there's widespread support for it, even in the rest of the Republican caucus. I don't think they want that on the floor. I think we're past the tipping point on LGBTQ issues where there's no longer a built-in majority for efforts that would alienate them in some way. So I don't see this going anywhere. It's something that is interesting and therefore will get news coverage because it's one of those explosive cultural issues. But I think the coverage it gets, the attention greatly outweighs its chances of passage.
I'm sorry, but it could stop the broader bill to ease the ability of people to adopt.
Yeah.
And you have all these children in foster care. By the way, James, I think it's important to point out it's the LGBTQ community, which certainly is upset about this. And the focus of most of the news stories is about LGBTQ adoptions. But that's not just what the bill would do. I mean, Brian talked about the Christian community that supports this effort. I'm Jewish. It is conceivable under the terms of this bill that if my Jewish wife and I want to adopt a child from a faith-based organization, they say, well, you don't believe in Christ, and we're not going to give you the baby. Yeah. This bill, my understanding at least, until someone explains that I'm wrong, would say they have the right to do that.
I'm also probably the only person in this room who thinks there will be something on social issues that will pass, because to me, the theory I have on it is that there's going to be a need for legislators to do something other than cut the budget, and this costs no money to pass no state money to pass some kind of a social issue statement. So it would not. I'm not saying this is the bill, but it wouldn't surprise me if something did pass.
And I do want to be careful because, Brian, when you talk about your former boss, the governor, vetoing a religious liberty bill, it was not the same bill that relates to adoptions, but it was certainly a comparable measure that dealt with the whole question of whether we should be passing religious liberty measures.
Right.
Kevin, we should also point out that the people who support this kind of legislation are the people who, for many years at the Capitol, have stopped a hate crimes law from being implemented because they have refused to allow for protections for LGBTQ citizens of the state. They don't want to codify them in any way. And Chuck F. Strachan faced that issue as a Republican when he tried to pass that measure last session.
I hope that you let your wife know about these adoption plans before you get out there. But aside from that, I mean, I like to connect the points that Mo and James made, which is it's like a campaign thing, right? They got a problem. Yeah. If they go back to campaign and all they can talk about is how they didn't save the programs that were so important in their district, they got to have something
point.
To talk about.
Great,
and that's the politicking,
that's a great
right?
point.
That's
okay.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to, because I see the clock and I want to say this, that, you know, Attorney General Chris Carr, you know, is letting Governor Kemp know just how expensive voter suppression is and asking for more money, you know, to be able to fight all these cases, record number of cases that are coming down over the prior election.
Right.
So, you know, he's finding out that, you know, purging votes, voter suppression is expensive.
Mo Ivory gets a point in a lick at the end, but you're not finished, Mo Ivory. You've got about a minute to answer a question of mine. I cannot let this show go without asking you about what is now the apparent outcome of the Iowa caucuses, where Joe Biden, the favorite of so many Georgia Democrats, could be on the ropes. Fourth place finish in Iowa, not having very energetic performances as he courts voters in New Hampshire. If this campaign turns south and Joe Biden is no longer a viable candidate for the Democratic nomination, what the heck is going to happen to all these Georgia Democrats like Keisha Lance Bottoms who've lined up with him?
So, I mean, it's early, and I know there was a lot of I was texting back and forth with a campaign staffer of Joe Biden's when Iowa, the night of Iowa was going on, and, you know, there was a lot of angst, and I think that it's really too early to say what will happen because we're just in a climate where, you know, we know anything can happen, right? And that's how we, you know, have our president right now. So I think it's too early really to say that. I think people should be concerned. I'm not saying that I haven't heard conversations and concern, but I still think it's just way too early to say that he's completely out or that, you know, Bernie is in or that Senator Warren is in.
Absolutely.
But just I think there is cause to be concerned.
But Brian, Kevin, James, there is a lot of focus of attention right now on the lack of energy, the poor performance finish in Iowa, and there are people who are saying, does Joe Biden really want this or not? And whether he's the best candidate or not, a lot of Georgia Democrats have staked their futures in terms of presidential politics on him.
Yeah, I mean, I think, too, the other thing that I noticed is as you dig into the numbers on how it played out in Iowa, there were just a lot of numbers that didn't seem to be good for Biden
okay.
in terms of how it broke.
So. We're virtually out of time. Brian, you happy about the way the Democratic primary seems to be unfolding right now? With it looks like we could be waiting for a long time to get a nominee as a Republican. Do you think that's good for your side?
I do. I think that Donald Trump comes out of the impeachment trial in the strongest position of his entire presidency.
There you go. Brian Robinson gets the last word. For those of you who say we don't respect Republican thinking on the show, you got the last word today, Brian Robinson. We're out of time for today's Political Rewind. We'll be back tomorrow with another show at 9 and at 2 and on TV at 7 tomorrow night. I'm Bill Nigut. See you tomorrow.